You're listening to Around Comics, watching before Watchmen, Night Owl, number one. I always want to do like a hip hop version of
that. But that would be good.
I don't know how to do that kind of thing. So
just throw a little record scratching in.
Probably not going to happen. It would sound very like 1991, I think. Yeah, a little of that. A little beatbox. All right. Thanks again for tuning in to Around Comics. This is another episode of Watching Before Watchmen. This episode is Night Owl number one, written by J. Michael Straczynski, with pencils by Andy Kubert. Inks by Joe Kubert, colors by Brad Anderson, and letters by Nick Napolitano? Napolitano. Sorry about that, Nick. This is the fourth installment of Watching Before Watchmen. If you have not listened to the other three, I suggest you go and listen to those. But not necessary. You don't have to. There's no real continuity.
There is a continuity. You're going to miss some of the story elements if you come in right. Just go back and listen to them.
Just go back and listen to them. Yeah, we're going to make you listen to all of them. They're free. It's not like you got to pay for it. So go ahead. Go listen to all of them. But there's three other ones out. We're going to take a look at every issue of the Before Watchmen mega event from DC Comics. And we're going to sit down and critique and discuss every issue that comes out. And this is Night Owl number one. But first, this episode is brought to you by Discount Comic Book Service. Discount Comic Book Service, where you can get up to 45% off the cover price on all your monthly comics. Right now, both Before Watchmen number one titles offered this month are 50% off. Jump in on the biggest event of the summer with 50% off both Rorschach number one and Dr. Manhattan number one. Also 50% off is the Valiant Comics Return Bundle. Only $7.98 buys you Archer and Armstrong number one, Bloodshot number 2, Harbinger number 3, and Exo Manowar number 4. If digital comics are what you're looking for, DCBS has you covered too. Use the buttons on the DCBS homepage to place your Comixology orders, and you'll earn 5% off those orders to apply towards your DCBS orders. Discount Comic Book Service has all the bases covered, so stop making excuses and get the best savings on the internet at DCBService.com. I guess let's just kind of jump into it. Well, I do want to preface one thing because I have a feeling that this episode may not be as positive as the previous episodes. And I do want to preface things by saying I, for one, am not a J. Michael Straczynski hater. I know there are a lot of people out there that, are not fans of his and don't like his work and think that he is not a very accomplished writer, and I tend to disagree with them, and I like...
Yeah, he's clearly accomplished.
Yeah, and so I want to put that out first before we get into things. I don't have any ill will towards Mr. Straczynski, regardless of what he's ever written in the past. So just a
yeah, warning. And nor do I.
You hate him, and you know it.
No, I love him. Oh. He's an actor. He's in Thor. Isn't that him? Didn't he find the hammer in Thor?
Yeah, I think you're right.
He's huge.
Is he that big, like, bearded dude? Like the big biker-looking guy?
He was the guy in the country truck.
I don't remember. I thought that was Stan Lee.
Well, he was in there, too.
Oh. All right, well, let's jump into it here. For those that don't know, Night Owl is Dan Dreeberg, or at least the second incarnation of Night Owl is Dan Dreeberg. And we begin this issue February 16th, 1962, and young Dan is sitting down to dinner with his mother and father. And right away, I kind of have a little bit of an issue with this opening. I guess, you know, it's sort of set up to try and make it seem like Dan is a bit of a dreamer and has his head in the clouds, and his father does not really agree with that, does not appreciate the fact. But I thought it was a little heavy-handed, and I also thought that it didn't make a whole lot of sense. His father's a banker who is, you know, someone that uses his head for work. It's not like he's a truck driver or construction worker where, you know, you would think the sort of prototypical blue collar father that doesn't want his son, you know,
doesn't put up with his son's
fanciful yeah. kind of ideas about yep. things and wants him to be more. But this guy's a banker. He's white collar and he uses his brain. He doesn't, you know, bust his ass at the bank to make money. So that seemed a little out of place to me with this opening.
I don't know. I mean, if you think of that movie, The Game, with Michael Douglas and his dad. I mean, there's a such thing as workaholic, you got to be perfect fathers who are successful. I didn't have a problem with that so much. I had a problem with not knowing what he's eating. it's like a green – maybe it's – what is it, cold soup?
Gazpacho.
That's it. That's probably what it is.
Could be, yeah, could be a cold soup. It looks like pudding, kind of. It doesn't really look like soup.
Looks like hell.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's yellow with little bits of brown in it, and yeah, not really good. But we see from this, we learn from this that Dan's father's a banker. He's wealthy, and they don't see eye to eye. And the next page, we open up, and Dan goes up to his room, sort of. You know, mopes up to his room, and he opens it up, and it's covered in Night Owl, the original Night Owl,
yeah.
Hollis Mason. It's covered in memorabilia.
This should be no surprise at all. I mean, we know Dan Dreiberg. We know his who he idolized when he was young and who he is going to come to be. So all of this is no surprise. So
no, absolutely. I like the scene. It's kind of neat. You see a lot of his little toys and gadgets and clippings and all sorts of different stuff, and you even see, like, the little statuette that is reminiscent of the one that that Hollis received for retiring and is eventually...
Across his head.
Yeah. Received it twice, I guess. And you see little models of stuff and toys and all sorts of stuff in his room. And also like an Erector set and some radios and looks like some electronic stuff that he's playing around with.
Yeah, because he's a smart kid. I mean, we know Dan Dreiberg. He's a bit of an inventor.
Mm-hmm.
So that's got to be put in there.
Sure, sure.
The next page, we go straight into the Night Owl proper, kicking some ass. Looks like he's kicking some ass at a are these guys that steal cars? What is this?
Oh, yeah. It looks like kind of a chop shop. Ring. Yeah, you know, it's the 60s and they're tearing apart some Model A's or something. I don't know. It's a little weird timing-wise, I guess. But
was there VIN numbers in 1962?
I don't know.
I meant to look
that up.
Yeah, look up when VIN numbers came into play.
I honestly could not answer that. I don't know the answer to that question, whether or not there were. I would think so.
Yeah, I don't know when they came in, but I just remember, and you know, maybe it's the presence of that 1930s hot rod in the background that kind of threw me even further back. But this is 1962, so let's.
Well, according to Wikipedia, VIN numbers were first used in 1954.
All right, they've been around.
Yeah, they were around, but it didn't stop guys from stealing cars and
look at me already trying to naysay Straczynski.
Already, you're gunning for him. But yeah, we see Hollis beating up some chop shop guys and you know, kind of making some cracks about it. And we get the feeling he's very, you know, sort of a bit of a, what do you call it? Gosh, I wish I could think of the word. Not a maverick, but he's freewheeling. He's sort of
Devil May Care.
Devil May Care. Yes, that's exactly the saying I wanted. Devil May Care. A little, but there's still another word. Not a buccaneer, but a
boutonniere.
not a boutonniere. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He's beating up bad guys, and then the next scene we see him outside, and he's the cops have the place surrounded. They're putting all the criminals in a paddy wagon, there's a weird, like, we see the crowd and even the cop, like, give this cheer.
Hoot hoot, man.
This hoot hoot cheer, which I'm not sure how I feel about the whole hoot hoot thing, the crowd hoot, and just sort of the way that Hollis is sort of,
He's a local favorite. I mean, he's a bit of Robin Hood, it would appear.
Yeah, I suppose so. It just seemed a little weird, I guess, but it kind of makes sense, I guess, at the same time. But anyway, we see as he's talking to the crowd and he's a little distracted, young Dan is behind his car putting what appears to be a homemade wire.
I guess it's a listening device. It's a receiver.
It's a transmitter.
A transmitter. He's got like a walkie-talkie deal.
Yeah.
And at the end of the page, he's listening as Night Owl drives away, and he's listening to church bells. He's listening to the things that the transmitter is transmitting so he can kind of hone in on exactly where Night Owl is going.
Right.
Which, God, that would be so freaking difficult. But apparently he's able to do it successfully. Let's see, the next page, this is basically more of him. They wrap it up in a page, you know, him tracking him down to this warehouse where the light is bleeding in on this door. Next page, he goes in, and lo and behold, it's this beautiful single page of the Night Owl's lair. And I liked it. I liked his lair. I thought it was kind of, you can tell he's a mechanic. He knows his way around machines and stuff. He doesn't have a lot of accoutrements like the modern day, or I should say, second Night Owl. He's just got a car, basically.
Yeah, I really like this panel too, or this page too. I really like the kind of scene.
You can even see where he turned around and backed in.
Yeah, and he's got some guns hanging up. He's got a bookshelf and a map, and you know, a TV, radio, some tools, and it was very cool, kind of like a really scaled down bat cave. You know, it's like his own.
It's very blue collar. It's a blue collar superhero setup lair type deal.
Yeah, he doesn't have billion of dollars to build a bat cave, but he's got the stuff he needs, to get the job done. And Dan decides to go in and explore a little bit. He sits down at Hollis's desk and decides to put on the Night Owl hood, or not hood, I guess it's a cowl, right? Is it a cowl or a...
It's not a it's some kind of a mask deal.
It's not a mask, though. It doesn't cover... It's a headpiece,
Headpiece.
And he starts looking around on his desk, and we see that Hollis has typed a letter, presumably for Dan, that says, 4 o'clock, Lincoln Park, southeast corner, green bench. And so Dan gets up and leaves the mask and leaves, and then we move on to 4 o'clock.
I guess 4 o'clock.
4 o'clock.
Green bench. Lincoln Park.
Yeah. And he sits down next to Hollis. He doesn't know it's Hollis, and they start talking, and Dan's very excited, and he's very ready to explain to Hollis how he wants to help him, how he has all these ideas and inventions that he could use and make Night Owl more useful, and how he wants to be Hollis's sidekick. And Hollis is sort of terse and to the point and doesn't say a whole lot.
Yeah, as expected.
Yeah. He wants to see who this kid is, and then he, you know, kind of explains to him, says, hey, you know, it's a good thing that I realized you were a kid or things could have gone really badly, and he shows him a pistol that he has under his coat the whole time.
Yeah, I like that. I thought that was you know, I mean, this is he's a man from the 1940s, 50s. So
yeah, so, I mean, yeah, presumably
shoot
you know,
your ass.
He's from the war, and you know, he doesn't he's not going to trust anybody, just anybody. He wants to see what this kid is about. And you see the difference between Hollis and Dan at this point, where Dan's this fresh-faced, very naive and you know, carefree kid who just wants to impress Dan. And Dan's, you know, or I mean, Hollis is...
he's got to vet him out.
Yeah, he's, you know, he's serious. He's not, this is no joke. This isn't a game to him. This is a serious business.
Man, you see how I dress at night? This is real.
This is, I'm in a suit, man. I'm wearing a black pinstripe suit with a trench coat just to meet you at a park.
I was talking about his costume with basic tidy whities.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not that serious.
Yeah, not so much. But the next page, we are at the expensive brownstone, and this must be the same brownstone. Well, it doesn't matter. Don't let me get into where we are. You know how I am.
I know.
So they get into the house, or I should say Dryberg, the young Dryberg gets home, and all hell is being broken loose in the living room with Ma and Pa, Dryberg.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at how it unfolded and what the mother says, apparently this is, you know, par for the course, run of the mill, how dad likes to party with mom.
Well, we should explain that, yeah, Dan walks in on his father in a, you know, appropriate wife beater with his belt out and apparently lashing Victoria, Dan's wife, who's in sort of a little nighty and yeah, evidently.
You mean Dan's mother.
I'm sorry, Dan's mother. And evidently, yeah, that's kind of, you know, a little foreplay or something for old man Dreeber.
Yeah, she said, can't we finish this later? So, yeah, apparently this, yeah, it's creepy. I mean, I was properly creeped out by this panel and his dad.
Well, I have a lot to say about this scene. And I don't know if you want to get into it now or you want to wait till the end to kind of go into what I think about this scene.
Are we going to talk a little bit about the art or?
No, it's not necessarily, no, not really the art. Just what this means for Dan and the writing choice of this scene.
We're on a good fast.
All right. We'll keep going. We'll get to the end.
Yeah. Okay.
So Dan, his father tells him to go upstairs, his mother tells him to go upstairs and he does. And Dan's father's sort of yelling at him on the way up and saying that he needs to know how a man behaves and that he started the process already. He needed to get rid of his goddamn dolls. And Dan walks into his room and all of his shelves are empty. His room is cleared out of all of the Night Owl stuff and evidently being burnt in a fire.
There's a fire. He looks out the window and there's a fire a-going outside in the, I guess it's like a little fireplace outside.
Yeah, a little fire pit. And so Dan goes out there and sits down for a little bit. And shortly thereafter, his mother comes out in a robe and... in a sort of matter-of-fact way, she announces that he should go inside and at some point call the hospital because his father's had a heart attack.
Mm, very fast.
Yeah, very quickly, for no apparent reason, he had a heart attack and she didn't do anything about it. And it was very matter-of-fact. And in the foreground of these panels, we see little tiny Night Owl being burnt in the fire.
Yeah, his dolls and such.
So then we move right to the funeral. And Dan's mother goes up to the casket, spits in his father's eye, literally.
Yeah, you thought she was going in for a kiss, you know,
right.
Final kiss. And she spits in his
eye.
In his face.
So,
it's bad.
And then in the rain, because it always rains in Watchmen during a funeral, we see Hollis come up to young Dan and basically say, well, now is as good a time as any to get started. taking him under his wing, if you will.
Now, how did you did? How did they leave? I mean, did Hollis, when they were at the park on the bench, did Hollis say, "Okay, all right, well, I'll get back with you"?
He said, "I'll think about it." Is basically what he said. He just was sort of like, "I'll think about
it."
So
I guess Hollis, in his own time, was perusing the paper, saw that Dreiberg's dad died, or did look at it.
Well, I mean, if you think about Hollis a little bit, and the idea of you know him wanting to feel this kid out even more, I wouldn't be surprised if he sort of followed him a little bit, maybe
looked,
you know,
into it,
looked into it a little bit, and found out who he was and where he lives and all that stuff, and has been kind of watching him. That wouldn't surprise me. And this is an interesting sort of moment, the one of the few that I thought was, you know, the correlation between Night Owl and, say, Batman, you know, where him coming to get his young ward after something tragic has happened to his father. You know,
Real quick, favorite panel, young Dreiberg at the end with the rain. That looks, that's a really good pay or good panel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. I really, every time I see the page, I hone in on that one facial shot of him.
Well, I think you can definitely see in his eyes, you see in the look on his face that, you know,
I don't know. Is he contemptuous of his dad? I mean, what?
Well, I think that, you know, he's conflicted because it's his father has died, but he doesn't really like his father. So how do you feel? You know, I think he's conflicted, and that is, that shows through in that drawing. I think you see that.
Yeah.
That he's sort of staring off into the distance, which is pretty hard to do, I think, you know, trying to draw that emotion, but I think you get it.
And he even looks owl-like. Did you catch that? I mean, does he not look owl-like to you?
Owl-like?
Yeah.
I don't know if I get that.
All right,
really.
Maybe it's just me.
I can kind of see what you're saying a little bit.
Yeah, he just looks owly.
Yeah, maybe. I think you're reading into it too much, but yeah.
Possibly. All right, the next page, we're getting down to training. We're starting off with, as you would imagine, with Hollis Mason. We're in the ring. This is how I envision Sal's workouts at his gym.
In a sweaty old gym.
Yeah, you know, with the ring in there. Well, you say you have a what is the MMA?
An octagon?
A Thunderdome or whatever it's called.
It's a chain octagon, yeah. The gym I used to work at, I don't work out there anymore. they ended up moving kind of far away, so I couldn't work out there anymore.
So he's training much like Sal works out.
Yes,
you know?
I don't wear headgear though. That's for pussies.
And the next panel, we're seeing how young Dreiberg is showing Hollis some of his designs.
He looks like he's showing him how to make Garfield, how to draw Garfield.
It does look like Garfield. It looks like
or Cheshire Fritz Cat, the Cat, maybe something. Yeah, Fritz the Cat, something like that.
And I just noticed, you know, when we were, just not to take us back to the page, but looking at Hollis Mason's car, Owl car,
mm-hmm.
Archimedes, Dreiberg's Archimedes, it's basically a revamped Owl car. So,
oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a bigger version of that. It's, yeah.
And what's this third panel? They're going out on their first mission or something? What is that?
Well, I think he's taking him around the town and saying, okay, this is how you hunt for crime. So he's like, are these guys, you know, legit or are they crooked? You know, you make the decision. What do we do here in this situation? And, you know, he's teaching him.
You're, to kick their ass.
Well, when you're out on patrol, you know, like you can't go attack the good guys or somebody that's just out working. You know what I mean? So it's like he's got to be able to tell the difference and use his brain to think about.
Don't want to get a bad name, you know?
Yeah. All of a sudden you start beating up some innocent dock workers.
Some guys working, you know, trying to make a buck.
That wouldn't be good. That would
yeah,
be
I
good.
Guess so.
And then we kind of get a little foreshadowing here at the bottom of this page where he's talking about the mask that he kind of redid and Dan saying, you know, wouldn't want people to confuse the two, and Hollis saying, well, that might not be such a bad thing. And he's like, well, huh? And, you know, it's just sort of a little moment of like, does Hollis have something up his sleeve? Is he
Yeah, he's about to hit him with some news.
Yeah.
some rather big news.
And then,
oh, well, wait a minute. No, he doesn't hit it right then. We go to May 12th, 1962.
Yeah, so that's, well, I'm trying to see. Let me flip back here. I can't remember what was the opening. It was like 1962. It was February 1962. So this is only a couple months
later.
Which you kind of think, well, he should train him maybe for more than a couple of months. But, you know, considering he's a, you know, weenie, like sort of skinny little nerd that, a couple of boxing matches. I don't know if it was good enough.
Well, he doesn't really. He's not on his own at this point, and we'll see in the next couple of pages. I mean, he trains the length of a college career. So
this is true. This is true. Yeah. But yeah, on this page now we see the announcement over the news and that Knight Hall has announced his retirement. That Hollis Mason has decided to hang up the cape and cowl and no longer be Knight Hall. And Dan is hears it. He's sitting in a diner reading the newspaper and sees it on the TV and takes off running for Hollis's place. And he gets in there and he's like, "What the
hell, man? What's up with that?" Well, and I thought that was a cool way to tell him. I like that story choice as opposed to just sitting him down and saying, "All right, man, she's all yours." I like the way he dropped it on the public and it got back to him.
I guess, except it doesn't seem like something that would really like instill trust in someone.
I guess he knew that it would come back to him that way. And he chose to, you know, he just chose to be a bit quirky about it and tell him.
Yeah.
And I could see the complaint the funny business you have about it, but I'll go with it. I'll take Straczynski's choice with it.
Okay, that's fine. He is the writer.
He is the writer.
And then you know, and Hollis basically says, "Hey, man, you made this decision easy for me because you can take over as Knight Owl for me. You need to train some more, but with my help, you can become the next Knight Owl, and I can retire because I want to go fish."
I mean, look at my temples, man. That's gray.
Yeah.
I'm getting old.
I'm an old man. I go gray on the sides and yep. Reed Richards it out, and I'm going to go retire. And Dan's sort of taken aback at first by it, but, you know, he's got some time. And then we fast forward 2 years, and all hell's breaking loose on the streets of, I don't know where.
New York.
Yeah, New York somewhere. Well, no, yeah, I didn't know where in New York, but police emergency, there's a blackout, people rioting, flaming Molotov cocktails being thrown through windows, thugs with iron bars and bats, and a woman about to lose her...
virginity.
Well, I don't know if she's a virgin. She might be a virgin.
But she's about to lose it if she is.
She her honor will be besmirched either way. And then we see
another strong page, single page image.
Single page image. We see Archimedes up in the sky,
yeah.
Lights flashing down on the crowd, and Night Owl standing atop the new Night Owl standing atop it with smoke in the background, and basically says, "All right, line up. I'm going to kick all your asses." And then he jumps down and proceeds to do just that.
Kick some asses.
And. You know, now we see Dan as he's a bit bulkier. He's got some muscle on him, and he's athletic, and he's got a little bit of that bravado that Hollis had, and he's just wades in with the help of Archimedes, who's got some voice command, as we know. And he beats the shit out of all these guys.
And this is his first public appearance, or is just this, you know, one of his first? What are you saying?
Well,
I'm going to say, this is why I asked, because the next page.
Why does it matter? I'm saying
this is why I asked. The next page, Night Owl gets back in Archimedes, and there's Rorschach in Archimedes,
right,
waiting to chat with him. And if this is his first outing, I felt like it was extremely weird for Rorschach to be up to speed enough to, you know, go ahead and hop in the Archimedes with him. You know, it's right. I mean, he just started. He, even if Rorschach's a crime buster.
Yeah, I mean, that would probably make sense that he, yeah. this is not, he's been around for a little while. And Rorschach's seen him.
He's got his attention, and yeah. Rorschach says, all right, you're worth
it. And also, I mean, you look at, like, how the cop at the end of the scene, you know, they're marching all the guys off, and the cop doesn't make a big deal about it. He says something about, yeah, now that the lights are back on, we're good, thanks, that, you know, sort of saying, now that you're back. But he doesn't, like, go, you know, he doesn't make a big deal about, like, oh, my God, Night Owl's back, that kind of thing. So I guess we can assume this is not his first outing. Just one of. It just happens to be...
Let's say it's not his first. That way...
That would make sense. I think it reads that way, and it makes sense. Like I said, Rorschach, you know, on his first outing, Rorschach just happens to be around the corner and decides to jump into his...
What the fuck is Rorschach doing in there? Is he meditating?
I think... Yeah, I don't... I'm not sure. That's a good question. He's sort of on the ground, sitting... But, yeah, his feet are underneath him, and it's a very strange-looking pose. It's odd. And Rorschach basically tells him, hey, we should partner up because I can watch your back, and we could go fight crime together. Which, you know,
I can watch your back, and I can cut people's throats with my bare hands.
Yeah, the next scene is like Dan's beating a guy up with his fist, and
look at Dan. I mean, he's even looking over behind him at Rorschach. He's like, "What the, did he just cut that guy's throat with his
did
bare
he just
hand?
Slit that dude's throat?" Which is just such a weird thing. Like, I don't think was Rorschach like murdering people
back then, especially. Did he do it like that? I mean,
does he have like razor blade fingernails or?
Yeah, or is he like some kind of vampire or something? Why are we slicing throats with our karate chopping hands?
I don't know.
And I didn't like that so much, but you know, whatever.
The scene's pretty good though. It's a nice montage, and you got
it's a scene that really makes sure that the gas that your foot is on the skinny pedal and you are going down the street because we're flying through time here.
Yeah. These two are partnered up, they've fought, they've done, and now in one page it's 1966 and they've been invited to a home to the crime busters. Captain Metropolis has invited them. Now, here's the weird thing about this. The house, it's like a brownstone, you know, kind of a big house somewhere in New York that they're going into, and once we get into it, you know, it looks very luxurious and, you know, very well off. And we know Captain Metropolis is well off, but he has that gigantic fucking lair that he bought and made into his, you know, super Metropolis, Captain Metropolis Fortress of Solitude.
Well, you know, the malting place. Yeah.
Yeah, the malt, Canadian malting. Like, where's Canadian malting? Why would he bring them all to this house?
I guess the obvious reason is because, you know, this is the moment in Watchmen where they have the meeting. So it wasn't at Canada malting. It was at...
Yeah, but if you look, I mean, I don't remember exactly. I didn't go and look it up. Maybe I should.
Well,
but I don't remember
it was,
seeing
it. I remember because they came out. There was some dialogue outside of the place. And you could see that it was
a home. I just remember a driveway and like a plant.
I remember that.
I think it could have still been the malting place.
Could have been the main office, you know?
Yeah, something. I don't know. Anyway, well, whatever. It doesn't matter. But so they're there, and they're, you know, Rorschach's a little nervous about it, and Dan is like, well, it's got to be right. And then Sally shows up, Sally Jupiter, and they introduce one another, and we get a weird panel about Dan both feeling like he has some sort of connection with Sally and is horny.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah. The next couple of panels is basically the same scene from a different perspective, I guess, from Watchmen, where Metropolis is trying to explain to them why they should all partner up. And then
it's almost a different perspective from the same scene in Watchmen.
Yes.
And these couple of pages in this scene shows you just how different this book is from Watchmen.
Yeah.
With the same characters. It's... Mm.
Well, you have all the same characters there. Everything's going on just the same way. And then Metropolis says he's going to partner everyone up. And he pulls a name out of a hat. And I thought that even felt okay, because Metropolis seems like kind of not naive, but sort of a Pollyannish, you know, kind of doofus in some ways.
From what we know about him,
what we know of him. And so he pulls a name out of, or a, it's not even a name, it's like a symbol out of a box. And it's
Rorschach's symbol.
Well, the first one is Metropolis, and he says, Dr. Manhattan. So he says, okay, it's Dr. Manhattan, thank you for being here. And now I'm gonna partner him up with, and he pulls out Rorschach, and then the Rorschach symbol changes to Silk Spectre. And when I first read that, I was like, what the fuck is that? Why did that? I couldn't understand it. Like, I didn't understand. I'm like,
why it changed.
Yeah, why? And then it dawned on me, it must have been Dr. Manhattan that did it, right? Because he's the only one in the room with the ability to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Is that something that Osterman was kind of doing back then?
Well, we know that.
I thought that she kind of fell into his lap, as it were. He wasn't, you know, behind the scenes trying to.
Well, not that we know of. And that's the weird thing about this scene, is that there's a couple of instances where they sort of smile and nod and there's these, you know, sort of knowing glances to one another. And it's all insinuated the future relationship and how it's going to break up his current relationship. But it was just done in a way that was like, well, Manhattan was so, I mean, at that point, he's so oblivious to any of that. I mean, and you even, when we saw it through his perspective in Watchmen, you never saw him like, I mean, it was inevitable. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, he knew it, that it was going to come to pass because he saw the future.
I think that Straczynski probably could have just limited that whole Dr. Manhattan switching the name chits for just him giving her a smile and her smiling at him, and then his girlfriend, or I forget her name, but given the scowl, that would have been fine. I don't know that we needed to, because now I feel like it's kind of not the same portrayal as he was. I mean, granted, he got more and more cosmically aware and aloof.
Yeah, true.
And who knows how, I guess.
And I know that in Watchmen there is a moment where he talks about, you know, seeing her and seeing how young she is, and he was obviously attracted to her.
Yeah, and he left, what's her name for her? So.
Yeah, but once again, it just didn't, the character didn't ring true to me in this.
And yeah.
The first time I really had a problem with it. But then you also have Dan once again sort of going, he felt this strange connection with her and with Sally and all that, and Rorschach kind of giving the line of, you know, maybe it was the same way as when somebody steps on your grave kind of thing. And it just was, it was like beating you over the head with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Totally. I get it. Like, I don't, you know, the fact that Dan and Sally end up together and they end up saving the world is something that you look at from two perspectives. You look at from the perspective of it was serendipitous, or you look at it from the perspective that it was fate, at least as far as Watchmen is concerned, as far as the original story is concerned. But in either case, you never looked at it like it was predestined and mystical,
mm-hmm.
and that they were ever aware of any of that. You know what I mean? It just existed.
I just thought that at this point, Dryberg was just horny when he saw her. And you know, he's a little bit insecure, what have you, because he's a kind of a geeky guy.
Yeah.
But now there's this whole underdog, they're actually connected type rhetoric. I'm not feeling it, but
yeah. And that's pretty much it. They talk about going to have lunch and
And then the next page we see what ultimately we know happens. comedian sets fire to Captain Metropolis's
map
diagram and his map, and Manhattan and his girlfriend leave with her giving him the
what for?
Yeah, giving him the mouth treatment, and Night Owl and Rorschach leave, and this is where they talk, and Rorschach. And, you know, I read a lot of reviews online of this, and I knew going into reading them that this would come up. And it's Rorschach's, his herm, right. Which is totally misused.
Yes.
Horribly. You know, when you heard the herm, the H-U-R-M, in Watchmen, it was because there was something underneath it. It was because Rorschach was
thinking,
you know, he was being a detective. Yeah. We were presented with whatever, and you know, we're punctuated at the end where Rorschach is going, her, and he's thinking about everything, just as the reader is also contemplating what he is having to contemplate.
It was basically
Tourette's.
Yeah. It was a very understated dun dun dun. That was what, you know, like Herm was sort of like, it made you pause and think about what he was doing.
Yeah.
And where he was at and what he had discovered and what he was working on. And it made that was what it did. It was sort of like,
he's got some kind of tick going on here.
Well, and honestly, like, you know, this to me, this characterization of Rorschach is very, I don't want to say poorly done, but it's very superficial. And this will get into a wider discussion on what I felt this whole book was, which was very superficial. But to me, I think you could have really explored more of Rorschach and not just kind of taken a photocopy of his character in Watchmen and shoved him into this book, which is what it felt like. And all of these characters, really, it just felt like someone, you know, read Watchmen and got a sense, or maybe not even read it, maybe just sort of read the Wikipedia on it and got a sense of the characters and then wrote this story from the beats of Watchmen. And I just have to, compared to the other three books that we've read so far, this is by far the worst of them.
And agreed.
I think this is the worst example of what we feared before Watchmen was announced. It was, you know, there's nothing here. There's nothing new here. This is just going over and over and over again what we've already read.
This is what this portrayal of Dreiberg's youth. I mean, I almost insulted you horribly. You're a great writer, but anyone could have wrote this because it's. I mean, basically, we rushed through, and I heard someone else talk about how we could have just had a story of the original Night Owl and Dreiberg training. You know, just that would be the story. There would be a story during that period
of
time.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But it brought us right on up to Watchmen. I mean, we're in Watchmen times now.
Yeah, and, it's very strange. I mean, even
how did this book end, Sal? I mean, what are we left with?
They walk out of the Crime Busters.
They walk out, and I guess the next issue. Where do you see it being? Rorschach and Night Owl.
I guess. I mean, maybe more. I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. I don't know where this goes because he's basically, I think he's used up all the source material from Watchmen. And it's like, where are you going to go with this story? So far, there is no story to this. This is just, you know, any of the interesting things that he could have done, he's already glossed over. Like the idea of, okay, let's just start at the beginning. The idea of what type of person Dan Dreiberg is and why he wants to become Night Owl. We never get a sense of why. We never really get any understanding of him as a person.
What's drive, other than he's fat, he likes.
Other than he's fascinated. He starts off
fascinated with Night Owl.
Why is he fascinated with Night Owl? And I think he completely screwed up the potential to do that with his father and his home life and his childhood, not using any of his childhood. And the little bit of home life we see is just this sort of, you know, just cliche kind of, you know, origin story. And it's like, it doesn't even make sense to me for Dan as a character. Dan is the bright-eyed optimist of Watchmen. He is, you know, even at four in his 40s, he's still sort of naive and you know, going into everything with a positive sort of outlook and an adventurous, more for adventure's sake than for anything else, and almost too just too naive to be afraid at times. And I think you could have done that with his, you know, with maybe making his father someone that had that spirit or that instilled that in his father. Instead, he makes him this guy that wants to crush all of his dreams and spirit and hopes. And how does that make Dan into that character? I don't understand how having watching but how does that opening that, how do the few things that he created new about Dan Dreeberg, you know, with his mother, being this beaten woman, his father being a you know, spousal abuser, a wife beater, and then his father having a heart attack and dying during it, and his mother not caring, and how does any of that turn Dan into the character that we see in Watchmen? It doesn't. It doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't do that character any justice,
right?
And I think he really missed the boat in pulling out. I mean, that's what this should have been. That's what all I think the Watchmen prequels here should be, is that let's find something interesting to tell about this character that we haven't already seen. And all he's done in this first issue is shown us everything we've already seen. And the few things that he's changed or made his own or created new don't make any damn sense with the characters.
Or he introduced them and then he immediately just moved on past them and progressed the story without developing anything. But I mean, he could have done that with his dad's, given you what you were talking about, the motive in Dreiberg. He had an opportunity, but I mean, that's right about the time where his dad had the heart attack or whatever.
I mean, wouldn't it make more sense if, and this is just off the top of my head, but wouldn't it make more sense if his father, you know, because he's wealthy, he wanted to show his son the world, and he brought him around to amazing, you know, they traveled together, and he showed them other cultures, and he showed him how other people live, and he showed them the wonders of the world. Wouldn't that make more sense?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's several things he could have done, but he didn't do any. What he did do, he didn't do it well enough to sell it to us.
Yeah.
In my opinion. And, you know, and I don't want to be overly critical, and I don't feel like we are being, but it's, you know, you're right when you said that this is what everyone
feared
and anticipated these books to be, was this sort of a thing. And I think that it was a bad move to bring them right on up into the Watchmen era, because now you get to see the glaring differences and characterizations of those characters.
Well, and
a different writer.
I mean, I don't know about you, but like for me with Night Owl, one of the most interesting nuggets that was just, you know, Alan Moore just kind of threw out there in the original story was that Dan found out who Hollis was. He was able to figure out who Hollis was.
We did that in 2 pages.
Yeah, it was like 2 or 3 pages, and it's like, that could have been the whole story. You know what I mean? Like, that alone could have been a more interesting story than
him,
what we got.
Him trying to impress Hollis enough to win him over and to become – I mean, the whole series, this whole little Night Owl series could have ended – the cap, the climax, the ending could have been – Hollis conceding and saying, you know what, you were good enough. And you know, the whole time Dreiberg was just trying to be a sidekick. Well, at the end of the story could be Mason saying, no, you're going to be the new Night Owl, not just my sidekick. And then that That would have been so awesome. But
or you could have done something along, you know, if you really wanted to be a bit more meta and play with the the parallels between, or the contradictions, I should say, between Hollis and his generation and Dan and his generation. You know, it's like Hollis is from the 40s, Dan is from the 60s. And, you know, the idea of Hollis being sort of old school and stubborn and stuck, you know, sort of in, you know, a little more hard nosed, and Dan coming along and showing him maybe more of the joy of it, or more of the, you know, just sort of brighter side of being a hero and helping people. And that could have played into it. You know what I mean? And sort of like the juxtaposition between Hollis's blue collar World War II sort of attitude and Dan's technology, and the two learning from each other. You know, there's a million things you could have done.
There's a million things you could have done other than bring us right into Watchmenville and show us, you know, how much this is not going to be the same story, the same characters, I should say.
Yeah, it just moved
too fast. I mean, we went way too fast, and there wasn't time enough spent in any one era to you know, glean any interest to keep on. But
well, going back to Rorschach, it's like, you know, as a character, he is basically the same character that we saw in Watchmen, and not, you know, the flashbacks, but when the book starts. That's the same character. And there's, to me, like, that's not how he started. You know what I mean? Like,
Rorschach, he was
that point because of, you know, he was mentally unstable, obviously, but also all the shit that he dealt with and how the world just beat him up and just grinded him down because he was so frustrated with the way the world was. Well, I don't think he started that way. He didn't, he didn't become Rorschach.
He wasn't cutting throats.
Right.
With
hands. Even in Watchmen, we saw how he changed when he changed because of the dogs.
If he's cutting throats back then, you know, the whole catharsis or the whole becoming of this really hard-boiled, cynical vigilante, it doesn't matter because, you know, he's always been that way.
His character arc is completely destroyed by this because he doesn't start as anything different than what he ends up as. And we see in Watchmen, you know, he was tying guys up and putting them on street posts and leaving them for the cops.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there was the kidnapping and the girl and the dogs and everything. And that's really what started him down this darker path and this more, you know, vigilante, more, you know, psychotic sort of path that really broke him. But from my memory, timeline wise, this would all be before that. So why is he already like this? And the Herm and the weird speech and the strange, it's like, I hope that we do not see this character in the Rorschach miniseries, because I can't put up with 4 or 6 issues of that. You know what I mean? Like it.
You got to, man.
Yeah.
We got to do it.
We got to do it.
We got to go back to this one. And you know, I was just going to say, man, I feel bad giving, I don't like being critical. It's been a long time since I've been critical. I voiced criticism online, you know, with someone's work, and you know, I just feel like it's kind of fair that these.
Well, I don't think we're pointing out anything that isn't our honest opinion about it. That isn't, you know, if you look at this book, if you read it, I can't see. Hey, give me an argument for it. You know what I mean? Like, if there's somebody out there, if you feel differently, if you really enjoyed this, then let's hear why, and let's, you know, give me the argument, because I'm not sitting here trying to rip this book apart because I want to.
And yeah, because it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted this to be good, believe me. So,
let's talk about the art. I mean, what about the art?
Artistically, I really enjoyed it. I think, and we should mention the interesting combination of Andy Kubert on pencils and then his father, Joe, inking him. I thought was really interesting that they did that. And I wonder if that's, you know, is that because Joe's maybe slowing down, or I don't know, doesn't want to do the pencils, or was it just something that they decided to work on together to do? But I really, I don't know. I have no idea what the answer is or why this combination was put together. But I really liked it. I thought it was looked great. I mean, the book looked great. I think there's some artistic choices that didn't, you know, I wasn't crazy about in some panels. Well, I, you know, like the weird Rorschach sitting in Night Owl's van. And, you know, there's a couple of
yeah, but is that Straczynski's choice? When does he say, all right, look, I want Rorschach to be sitting like a freaking Sphinx frog?
Well, maybe. You know,
and I want a fight scene. You just go ahead and you do whatever you want to in the fight scene. Just make sure that Rorschach is slicing someone's throat with his bare hand. Is that Straczynski?
I don't know. I didn't see the script, so it's hard for me to say. Only they could answer that, really. But you know, there's another scene that I thought was confusing when Dan first comes home and catches his father beating his mother, and then he goes upstairs. It took me a while to realize what we were looking at because it looked like a ladder. He walks in and we see an empty bookcase from behind. The perspective is from behind the bookcase.
Yeah.
Which would presumably mean my eyeballs are on a wall. I just thought that was a strange choice for that. Because to me, it looks like like he's looking at a ladder. And it took me a couple of times to realize what.
Well, it didn't trip me up because I saw it earlier when we went in his room. It took me. I had to go back to see. For some reason, I didn't recognize that all of his stuff had been taken. Oh, wait a minute. No, that ladder's not in.
It's not a ladder.
That's a ladder.
It's an empty bookcase. That's what I'm saying. Why is there it looks like a ladder, but it's an
empty bookcase. No, that is a ladder.
No, it's an empty bookcase. It's an empty bookcase, but we're looking at it.
Well, it's too narrow to be that bookcase that's portrayed.
There's no ladder in that room. He walks in the door in the first scene, and he sees the bookcase full of everything, and he looks into it. Now we see that same bookcase from inside the bookcase, and it looks like a ladder. That's what I'm talking about.
If your eyes were on the back of the bookcase that's portrayed, then you wouldn't be able to see through it. Like, you wouldn't be able to see the edges.
That's why it was a bad art decision.
Yeah.
you know, just some of those things. But overall, I think it looked really, you know, I liked it a lot. I thought, you know, the combination of the two worked really well. I mean, I'm a huge Joe Kubert fan. You know, and I love his work. So, you know, him inking his son is pretty interesting. I think it adds a different energy to his work. You know, I don't know. I might have liked it even more if it was just Joe doing it, but I think it almost emulates sort of like an old school kind of look, but it doesn't look.
It does look old school to me.
It doesn't look too old school though. Like there's, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't, there's still enough modernness to it, I think, but there's no.
Yeah, I mean, the colors definitely bring it up to, and yeah, you know, I got no complaints with the coloring job. They do some good local color, foreground, background.
Yeah.
We do the dreaded, and the don't ever use the lens flare. we actually use lens flares. The colorist used lens flares on the scene where Archimedes is coming over the crowd, but I think it looks good.
Yeah, I think the coloring was very well done. I mean, it's, you know, you're using a lot of browns and purples and blues with this, you know, with Night Owl, it seems like, but he found places to put other colors and I think he used it well, but, yeah, artistically, I think it was very good. I really had very few complaints about it. But as a story, it really fell short for me. It really was a disappointment. I was looking forward to this. I was hoping it was going to be much better than it was. And I was too. I was not. I just think there's so much to that character you could have done. You know, and even like I said, even if you just wanted to play with the Batman analog, it's like, you know, well, here's another thing that made no sense to me. Why would he get all the money just because his father died? His mother's still alive. Did she just hand him all his money?
That doesn't bug me so much. I mean, you know, maybe there's enough money to go around, and that's not a story point that I've got to have laid out for me. But yeah, I mean,
no, but it just sort of goes to the idea. It goes away from the idea of the original, you know, Watchmen, where, you know, he's sort of the Batman analog, and it's, you know, he inherits all this money because something tragic.
But their mother, we don't know what happens to the mother. She's
I really, really, really despise the idea of Dan having a dark childhood. Dan was the, like I said, he was the optimist to me. He was, you know, he was one of the only characters in Watchmen that didn't have such messed up personality disorders and didn't have that dark past and didn't have those issues in his life.
So you just don't like that choice.
I hate that choice. I think it's I think it is a terrible choice.
Well, you gotta recognize that. I mean, if this had been a better story, and if that choice had been made to make him have a bad childhood, we could still be a viable good.
Well, the only way it would make sense though is how the only way it would be better is if it made sense, if it added something to the character, and it doesn't. It's just like thrown in there. It's just like, well, we need to have Dan have a fucked up childhood, so his father beats his mother.
Yeah,
there's no point to it. It doesn't add anything.
Yeah, fucked up childhoods by default doesn't mean that the story's going to be interesting. I mean, and I think maybe that was
Not to say that it couldn't have been. Not to say that it couldn't have worked in that sense.
I mean, it's a bit cliche,
but it was just cliche because it didn't add anything to the story. It doesn't add anything to Dan. It doesn't change who he is. It doesn't do anything to him. You know what I mean? And I'm sorry, but that's going to affect you one way or another. Now, I'm not saying it's going to affect you negatively necessarily. It could affect you positively if you're strong enough, and you know what I mean? Like, he decides that's why he's going to go protect people. But it's never even, there's no reason for it. It doesn't do anything. It's just thrown in there, and that's the definition of cliche. That's, you know what I mean? Like, that's just bad storytelling. That, you know what I mean? Like, there's no
hackneyed.
Yes, it's just.
Oh, we shouldn't say that at all, though. That's really
hackneyed.
Well, I mean, that's just that's very mean to say.
You know,
what does hackneyed mean? That means basically you're engaged in cliched artistic choices. Because they're popular, isn't that what hackneyed means?
I have no idea. You're using the word and don't even know the definition.
I used it to ask you.
I think it's like more like it's trite. You know, there's no hackneyed is a perfect word for it because I think it's like there's no significance to it. There's no there's no reason for it. It's just it's thrown in just to throw in, you know, it's lacking any kind of substance behind it.
Well, I don't know where this story is going to go next, but we have to do an episode on it when it comes out.
I know we will.
And I don't know where it's going to go. I'm not compelled. I'm compelled on the other three issues. I want to see what happens next.
Yes, absolutely. The other three, I ended each one going, okay, I'm interested. I want to know what happens to these characters next. This one, I'm interested, but almost in the opposite way of like, what the fuck is he going to do now? You know what? You know,
you could have done a whole series on Night Owl's different suits and his and his cave and like all of his technology. I would have been like all about it.
Well, I agree with you that there were.
You could have done a whole series on one adventure, like one. He just starts out. This is his first. You could have done a whole series on his first adventure, and maybe him learning the ropes. And something haywire goes wrong. That was it.
Yeah, well, I think there was plenty of space between the raindrops with Dan to find a good story, and I just don't think that Straczynski took the time to try and do it. I honestly, I don't even feel like this is poorly written because he's a bad writer, because I don't believe he is a bad writer.
No.
I think this is poorly done because he didn't give a shit. He didn't.
I felt like he didn't give a shit. So.
It felt like, I mean, it really just felt like he mailed it in on this, that it was very little actual work done on it, very little concern with the character, with the story. I don't want to bash on Straczynski. And
do you think this will get back to him this episode?
God, I can't imagine it would. Who the hell's gonna? I'm sure he doesn't listen to my podcast, our podcast. I have no idea, but even so, it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Like I don't. I tend to try and look at a creator's work and give it the benefit of the doubt, because no matter what, no matter how bad it is, in my opinion, one, it's just my opinion, and two, somebody worked hard on it.
That's it.
You know, yep. So generally, I'm pretty easy on stuff. This one, the Kuberts, I give all the credit in the world. I think it's
absolutely
really well done. Straczynski, absolutely. It really feels like he mailed this in, like he didn't take the time that he should have on something so. Already so sort of, you know, so much of a firebrand, so much of a controversial thing anyway, to then mail in an issue on it.
Yeah.
It seems like you're just, you know.
Every story decision he made was safe. I mean, you ever watch Chopped on one of the Food Network channels or what have you, and when they critique some of the
I don't watch cooking shows.
I do. Oh my God!
People love them. I don't.
I love them.
I don't
but,
enjoy.
But when the four chefs present their food, some of the critiques that the judges give. One of the critiques is, "Well, this is a safe choice. You just decided to make this is safe. It would have been a lot. It would have been a lot better if he would have stuck in some pocket." Event and then made crazy choices, but he decided to just take him right on up into Watchmen, fly us on up there, and then make cliched safe story decisions.
I agree.
All right,
that's enough of it. I think that's
we're probably going to get Molotov cocktailed by.
By iron bar wielding thugs,
not top dudes,
not top.
We didn't even talk about the Crimson Pirate. Corsair. Yeah,
yeah. I'm getting a little. I don't know that. I'm getting a little bored by that story. It's not very interesting to me.
This one got me.
You like this one?
You know, right. Normally,
well, go ahead.
Normally, I forget about it. You know, but this one. I mean, for Pete's sake, man, we was falling off the side of a ship going to Davy Jones's locker in the last one.
True.
So we're heading down to the deep abyss, tied to a cannon, and our character or protagonist is able to get free of the rope and swim to the surface. I think I was critical of the. That it wasn't flowery enough, or that the language in the narrative wasn't compelling enough. I take all that back. This is a reversal. This one was a lot better. So he sees the ship that sunk his ship. Well, apparently he gets to the surface, and there's been an explosion since he was going to the drink, and when he came back up, the ship is completely gone, and the attacking vessel. The Spanish frigate is disappearing into the horizon. So he swims along and he sees a crew member on a bit of debris. But when he gets up, the
somebody,
crew member,
somebody knew someone.
Yeah. Raleigh. When he gets up to, try to address him, he's already expired. He's dead. So he gets his clothes and he sends him. He puts the body back in the ocean. Well, the last panel is one of nightmares, Brian Salazar. I can't figure it out. I mean, is Raleigh? Well, we're to understand that this is now Raleigh that's coming up out of the water.
Well, yeah, he dumps him over the side, and then he's cruising along, and all of a sudden, yeah, we see this sort of face come out of the water, but it's like...
It doesn't look like a face that's emerging from the water. It looks like a face that is kind of...
One of the water. It's part of the water.
One with the water.
Yeah.
Rule of thumb, when you get rid of a... Or a hard and fast known fact. When you get rid of a dead body in a body of water, if it were to float up, it coming up head first, face first, in your face is always...
Can be scary, a little terrifying.
Yeah, it makes you, you know, do the whole Roy Schneider bolt up maneuver. I don't know where we're going from here, but you know, I'm just as interested to see the next two pages as I was this one, because I want to know what the hell is going on with Raleigh's crazy face coming up out of the water.
Well, there you go. They got you on this one. I you know, I will say the art on this is really good. I think John Higgins has done a really good job on this so far. But I, so far the story, I guess I'm waiting for the story to connect it all to the story that it's in. And it's, I guess it's really hard to do. I guess I was sort of expecting it to kind of connect in some way, or at least feel linked to the other stories that I'm reading, but so far it really hasn't anyway. And maybe that's asking too much of it.
Two pages per, yeah, per hit. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I couldn't imagine trying to write something two pages at a time. I mean, of course you got to have a lot of text, and it of course does, but even with all the text, it's still hard to get a good forward momentum going. Well, the next comic in the series we've got is Ozymandias.
Ozymandias.
Who do we like? I mean, Ozymandias and Rorschach, is that it?
I believe so, yeah. We have, yeah, those couple.
Yeah, we got a lot of shows.
One? It seems like there's another one.
They need to do one with Captain Metropolis, man. I'd be on for that one.
Ozymandias number one, yeah, that's next. That's written by Len Wein with art by Jay Lee, which should be interesting. Big fan of Jay Lee, so that'll be kind of fun. I'm a little down right now because of this issue. I'm hoping we pick it back up with Ozymandias, but yeah, that was it. This is Watching Before Watchmen, Night Owl number one. Thanks for listening again. I'm Sal, and you are Braxton. You still there? Did I lose you? Braxton.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You know what I did? I sat on my mute button.
Oh.
did you hear me say I'm Braxton?
No, I did not.
I guess everyone probably immediately thought, wow, he is down. He just said, just fuck it, and got off the...
He's done.
He's done. He's out. Dropped the mic, you know, and walked off the stage.
Yeah, right. So I'm Sal, and you are...
Braxton.
There we go. That's better. And thank you for listening. I do want to remind people that this episode is sponsored by... This episode is sponsored by Discount Comic Book Services, dcbservice.com. Get all your comic books there because they're cheap and they're good and they're nice people and they're from Indiana. So what else could you possibly ask for?
Zach Krusey.
Zach Krusey doesn't work there any longer.
No, he really?
No, he does not. He is now doing something else with his life. But they're still pretty good people, so even without Zach.
All right.
We have a website, aroundcomics.com. You can go there. There's a forum. You can email us at info@aroundcomics.com. You can follow us on Twitter at aroundcomics. We have a Facebook page, facebook.com/aroundcomics. My Twitter handle is @BrianSalazar, BrianSalazar. Yours is @Braxton9, BraxTon9, number nine.
Correct? Number nine. Oh, man, I may pick up a couple of followers from this little.
You might. But wow. Please come to our website or email us or Twitter us if you have anything to say about the episode. We would love to hear from you guys.
Yeah, another thing you could do is go to the forum. We had one guy come to the forum.
It's so demoralizing. I used to have a vibrant. Ron Comics had an awesome
army.
Yeah, we had a great forum at one time, and now after I changed it and then got rid of it, and
people
now
are like,
we have one. We have one forum member now. It's kind of sad.
But I mean, you know, look, if you want to come on and be heard. I mean, if you were to come on and you know, add to this discussion or any of the other discussions on the books or the future ones, you can basically have our attention. You know, we're right there. And another thing, maybe in the future we might could revisit some, because the one guy that did post on the forum, he brought up some interesting things about the comedian.
Yeah, so, absolutely, and we'll see if that's...
Maybe we can come up with a slot or something to bring up people's posts. I don't know. Hey, man, that's your arena. I'm just
throwing shit out there.
Yeah, I'm just throwing it out there.
And that's it. That is Watching Before Watchmen, Night Owl. Thank you all, and...
Good night.
Good night.